Before we begin today, I want to thank you listeners for helping 501c3BS blowing up into one of the top 10 podcasts for the social sector. You can help us even more by following the podcast, liking it, reviewing it, or sharing it in your social media. The more followers we have, the more episodes we can produce, helping you clear away the BS from your mission. Thank you. And now, on with the show. Today, we wade into the misty swamp of human resources with HR expert and consultant Heidi Steele. Even those among us with years of experience in leadership still struggle with the mythology of human resources. We spend so much time on fundraising and making sure we have enough capital. But what about human capital? Are we making mistakes that could land us in court and cost us large sums of money? Are we doing the best we can for our employees? Do we have special rules that only apply to us? When should someone be part-time and when should they be a contractor? Most of us know that some employees can be exempt from overtime if they make twice the minimum wage and do important senior assignments, but when is it okay to make an employee exempt? Does the size of the organization change the rules? How do you get HR help when you are small? Should you hire a consultant, a firm, or staff for HR needs? How do you incentivize employees to stay with you longer? Can great benefits save you money? How does training fit in? How do you handle financial hardships with staff? Many tech companies are making salaries open. Should salaries be open for all to see? What about equal pay? When should you give raises and to whom? What about temporary hires, such as for grant-funded programs? And can employees volunteer for the organization? Well, we'll clear up all this BS, these myths, and these questions for you today on 501c3BS. Welcome to 501c3BS, deprogramming for organizational growth. I'm your host, Zoot Velasco. We just need one big fundraiser.
Our clients are our donors.
Bigger is better.
Who cares what the mission statement is?
I work in nonprofits.
Bullshit!
Heidi Steele, welcome to 501c3BS, where we talk about all the myths of the nonprofit sector. And today we're going to talk about your myths of human resources and human relations and all of those things that HR means. And you were highly referred to me by Todd over at the Orange County Community Foundation, and he says you are the guru for Orange County. So welcome to the program.
Wow. Well, that's a big compliment, but thank you for having me today.
And tell me where we are. Where are we sitting today? Because this is one of the places that you work at. You're a freelancer, right?
I am. I'm a contractor. And this is a really special place. This is Casa Teresa. And Casa Teresa provides shelter and education to moms and to women who become pregnant and cannot financially take care of themselves.
And I used to work with Crittenden Services that does a similar thing for underage girls. And I think this is for women who are over, emancipated age. So they're over 18, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So that's great that you work with them and you take care of their human relations issues and many other people. I'm assuming you have many other clients as well. So tell me a little bit about your, what are the things that drive you crazy in HR in terms of misconceptions that people in our industry have about what is good and what is bad practices in HR?
Well, it's interesting because just because you're in the nonprofit world doesn't mean that you're not subject to all of the employment laws that are for private employers. Basically, the laws are the same. The laws are driven by the size of your company or your organization, but the laws are all the same.
And so people sometimes think that because we're in the squishy little quote-unquote nonprofit sector, that we don't have the same rules apply to us. And I know I've run into that because we had an episode where we talked about law issues, and one of the legal issues was this idea that if you're in a small organization, you don't have to follow the same rules in terms of minimum wage and exempt employees and all those kinds of things. But they do, right?
Absolutely. So there's many different employment laws for employers that have, or even nonprofits that have under 25 employees, one of them, the one that you're referring to, is the Fair Labor Standards Act. In HR, we refer to it as the FLSA. But basically, that is that's employment law. And you need to first determine if your employees are exempt or if they're non-exempt, meaning are they eligible for overtime and meal and rest periods, or are they exempt, meaning they're generally paid on a salary and they're not eligible for those same meal and rest periods. And overtime. And so that's a significant law. It also sets out that employers, nonprofits alike, need to pay minimum wage. And these days, there are different minimum wage laws in cities, in counties, states, and of course, federally. So you need to look up what minimum wage law applies to you for your non-exempt employees.
So here in California, we have a law that if you're an exempt employee, you have to make a minimum of twice the minimum wage. Is that true across the country, or is that just a California law?
That's a federal law. So that's true across the country.
Good. So what is the difference between a contractor and a part-time employee? A lot of people, I think, in our industry have the misconception that you could just put anybody in as a contractor. For example, I work in arts nonprofits a lot. We'll hire artists to do teaching jobs, and we have to be very careful about when they cross the line from a contractor to a part-time employee. But just in general, what is that line?
So that particular law is very, very tricky. To determine if someone is an independent contractor is challenging because you need to look at the various rulings that have occurred. There isn't a black and white law. There are about five different government entities that regulate independent contractor status, and that particular area becomes really tricky. It's important not to make a mistake in that area because you could be subject to back payroll taxes. In fact, you could be subject to penalties, workers' comp insurance, possibly even benefits that you missed because you misclassified someone as an independent contractor versus an employee. So it's important to take a hard look at various characteristics of that individual. You know, are they performing services for the core business that you provide? How much control do you exercise over this particular individual? Are you controlling when they need to work, their place of employment, the hours that they work? Are you providing them with various instruments or tools to do their job? Are they really specialized at what they do, or is their work more general in nature where it's not specialized, meaning if it's specialized, they might more likely be a contractor, and if it's not specialized, they might more likely be an employee. So there are various factors that you look at to determine.
It's a lot to consider.
It's a lot to consider.
So, if you get it wrong, as you said, you could be liable in a lawsuit for back taxes, back workman's comp, back wages, all kinds of things could be very expensive for you. But generally, as a rule of thumb, if you have some people on your payroll doing a particular job and other people as quote-unquote contractors doing the same job, that probably won't fly, right? Unless they're doing something very specific, and a very, you know, like in our case, we would have full-time or part-time artists that were teaching artists, but we needed somebody just for animation. So we would hire an animation artist just for that, and that would be a contract position. But if they're doing the exact same job, and some are part-time and some are contractors, that probably won't fly, correct?
Correct. If they're doing the exact same job, it would be very difficult to classify them as an independent contractor. And maybe a really good rule of thumb to follow is this person in the business and do they have other work in the area that you're hiring them for? If they don't, there's a good chance that they're probably an employee.
So if you're hiring a contractor for HR, for example, and they're a professional, they're an HR professional that's part of HR associations and they have other clients, then they're, you know, it's pretty easy to say, okay, they're a contractor. But if you have an HR professional on the payroll and you're having them work part-time and this contractor part-time doing the same thing, that may not fly.
That's correct. And so in that particular situation, you would have to look at, you know, at least 11 different factors to sort of ascertain if there's any merits for that one individual to be an independent contractor or not.
You know, one thing I found out, I have a friend who was also a funder of our organization that is an insurance guy. And he told me, you know, if you miscategorize people, they could be not insured when you come down to needing insurance for them. So something happens to them on the job or off the job, whatever, and you're expecting that insurance to cover them. It may not cover them if you miscategorize them.
Yeah, that's correct. If you're not characterizing them as an employee and they have a workers' comp incident, it would be very difficult to get them coverage after the fact, because technically they're not on the payroll at the time of the accident.
So the rule of thumb for contractors then is that if you're hiring somebody who has multiple clients doing a very specialized task that they're an expert in, that would qualify as a contractor as long as you don't have someone on your payroll doing the same exact same task for a different amount, different kind of a setup.
Yes, more than likely. And again, just being careful that they have, you know, control over their schedule, control over how right. they deliver the service to you and that type of thing.
So let's get back to exempt employees for a minute. I think there's a lot of confusion about this. I know for a long time I was confused about this. I thought anybody who I was willing to pay more than twice the minimum wage full time to do some, you know, major work at our organization, I could just make them exempt. But that's not the case. They have to be considered senior staff, really in a management type position to be an exempt employee, correct?
Yes. So there are different type of federal exemptions. And there's an executive exemption, there's a professional exemption, there's an administrative exemption, there's a sales exemption, and there's these different types of exemptions. And you really have to take a close look at the job duties that the person is performing in order to really determine if they're exempt or non-exempt.
So you can't just have a receptionist that works a lot of hours, so you're going to make them exempt so that you don't have to pay them overtime.
Correct.
They have to be doing some kind of administrative job at a managerial level or supervisory level, correct?
Yeah, technically, I mean, they need to be able to exercise management decisions within the company or have a position where they're, you know, they're interpreting company policy and such, and they're making decisions based on the company policy. They need to be exercising their independent discretion in order to be considered exempt.
So the advantage for an employee to be moved up to an exempt category is that they're now in senior management. They have a more important role. There's a lot more respect involved with that, probably a better job title. And your advantage is that you can, if they have to work an unusual schedule or if they have to work extra hours one week for something, you're not required to pay them overtime. But the flip side of that is you can't overuse that. You can't decide they're going to work 60 hours every week.
Well, and the flip side is if you misclassify someone, and if they should have been classified as non-exempt all along, technically you could be on the hook for paying missed meal breaks, missed rest periods, missed overtime, including penalties and penalties on top of that, which can really add up. So oftentimes it's better to reach out to your human resources professional or to an attorney and really make sure that you have properly classified your employees, because when you do make a mistake, it costs a lot more than it would if you had just done it right all along.
And this is why it's great for small organizations that have a very important mission in the community to try and get people on their board who know about these things, either, as you say, an attorney or an HR professional. If you can get someone like that on your board, you can save the fees you would have to pay to get that advice professionally as a consultant, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that would be a huge advantage for any nonprofit organization.
So there's a myth that exempt employees kind of solves all your problems. You just make everybody exempt, and then you don't have to worry about a lot of things. But as you point out, if they're miscategorized, you could be up for a lot of problems if there's a lawsuit involved.
That's correct.
What are some other myths that you have run into with exempt employees being miscategorized or people wanting to make people exempt for maybe the wrong reasons? Have you ever run into any problems with that?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say that I've run into problems with it, but I think I've had questions all along about, you know, whether someone should be exempt or non-exempt, especially as you're creating a new position for an organization. You know, it's the first time you're going to have this particular employee in this role. Anytime you have a new position, it always makes sense to really dot your I's, cross your T's, do a quick evaluation as to whether they should be exempt or non-exempt. That way you start off on the right foot from the get-go.
And it's not always an advantage to have somebody exempt either, because you have to pay them more money to be exempt and they have to be full-time. It may solve some of your issues to have multiple part-time employees at a lower salary doing a job than one full-time employee as an exempt employee too. I mean, it's not always a better thing to have an exempt employee.
That's correct. And these days, there are even state laws across our country that are driving up the minimum salary requirement for an exempt employee. And so I'm finding in my experience, more often it doesn't make sense to classify someone as exempt because the salary level is frankly just too high.
I was going to ask you if you noticed that since minimum wage has become such a big topic in the last 4 or 5 years, that, I mean, it's always a big topic, but the last 4 or 5 years, it's become kind of one of the major topics in political elections. And since that's happened, I'm wondering if you've noticed that employers in general are hiring more part-time and less full-time employees. Has that hurt full-time employment in America?
I wouldn't say that it's forcing employers to hire more part-time, but I can honestly say that I think employees are taking on more and varied responsibility. So I'm seeing maybe less employees where...
Doing more work,
yeah.
So even in for-profit businesses, that's the case.
Oh, yeah, I would say so.
And that, again, could set people up for lawsuits as well. I think we're lucky in our line of work because people work for a mission more than a salary. And people are willing to do things sometimes outside of class because they care about the mission of the organization. Sometimes you're not even asking them. They're just doing it because they care. I think we get that more than the for-profit world.
I would agree. I would say my experience in working with nonprofit employees is they really have a drive to get things done. They are driven by the mission. And so fortunately, I've noticed employees raising their hands to do more and take on varied and more challenging responsibilities. So, you know, I think in the nonprofit world, it certainly has worked out just fine.
I should make the case that in this podcast, we try to avoid the N-word nonprofits.
Okay.
Because we think of it as kind of a negative way of talking about our sector. But when we're talking about tax status, which, you know, we are kind of doing when we're talking about for-profit versus nonprofit, it kind of doesn't make sense to not do that. But we try to make a habit on this podcast to talk about community benefit organizations, social profit organizations, or just NGOs, non-government organizations, as a better way to talk about our sector rather than what we're defining ourselves by what we don't do well, which is make a profit.
And, you know, I always think of it as a positive thing.
Really?
I do, because they're the organizations that are doing something for the community they serve.
Right. Yeah, but to call yourself a nonprofit is maybe not always the best way to put your mission out there into the public as, oh, we're the people that don't make a profit.
Oh, sure.
It's much better to say we're the people who our profit is community benefit or, you know,
right,
community social work or, you know, something that relates to the community rather than, oh, yeah, we're the ones that can't figure out how to make a profit. So a lot of people, I think, in our industry who are in small organizations that have less than 20, 25 employees have had this idea that they go by a different standard because they're a small organization. And I know in some cases there are rules that kick in when you have over a certain number of employees. Is there a different standard for small organizations versus large organizations?
There are some different standards. So employment laws are employee count specific, but there are...
Wait, what does that mean? The number of employees.
Right. So if you have one or more employee, you're subject to the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Right.
The one we were speaking about earlier. And it's not until you get to 50 or more employees, just to draw a big distinction, that you're required to follow the Family Medical Leave Act. So depending on the size.
So there's some benefits that change as you get older as far as what you're required to do.
That's correct.
As you get bigger, I mean.
That's correct. But the small organizations still have a lot of rules to follow. So, you know, under 20 employees, there's some key laws to follow, not only FLSA, which we talked about earlier, but you still have to follow Americans with Disabilities Act and the Equal, the Fair Pay Act. So there's a lot of significant regulations that are required at a small size.
And you know, one thing that really bothers me about our sector is that we're organizations who are trying to make the community better. And we're, we tend to think of ourselves as highly ethical, highly evolved people that are trying to make a better world. But then I hear small organizations saying things like, oh, you know, we can skirt that rule or we could get away with this because we're small. And that kind of goes against what you value yourself as an ethical person, right? So for small organizations that don't have large budgets, how can they get the right advice on HR? What are there places that they can go in the community for help? Are there maybe HR organizations they could look to for potential board members? What can a small organization that doesn't have a lot of money do to get the proper advice?
There are definitely things that they can do. There are, for example, there's an organization in California called Cal Chamber, and any company can pay a membership fee, and it varies based on your employee size and payroll, but they can pay a membership fee and they can get an ongoing newsletter to keep them informed about the various changes in human resources and employment law. There's other organizations like CEA, that happens to be a California-based organization as well. And there's, you know, organizations like that where it's an annual fee.
Is there a national organization that people can go to find out which one is applicable in their state?
I can't think of one off the top of my head.
I'm sure they could Google it though and find out. But people could also talk to estate attorneys or tax attorneys or HR attorneys that deal with these kinds of issues all the time, might be able to recruit them to a board and get advice from them as well.
Oh, sure. If you had an employment, a labor law attorney on your board, that would be hugely beneficial.
And they could also help with things like contracts and other things besides just HR issues, right?
Absolutely. Because you might have, properly classified independent contractors. And if you do, it's important that you have an agreement with them.
So if you're hearing this podcast, hang up immediately with your receiver and go and find a labor law attorney before somebody else does, right?
Yeah.
Put them on your board. Okay. I do think, since we're talking about recruiting board members, it's important for people to also know that you shouldn't just go and hound somebody to be on your board. You should try to get them involved with your mission first to make sure that your mission is something they care about, or else they're not going to be very helpful to you. That's for any board member, really. All right. So if people are hiring an outside consultant for HR issues, what are the advantages and disadvantages of doing that rather than hiring someone part-time in-house or a consultant? Hiring a consultant like you versus hiring a part-time person. When does one make more sense than the other, I guess?
Well, an advantage to hiring a consultant versus in-house is that your consultant, depending on your size, you might not need even a part-time person working 20 hours a week to do human resources. You might need something less than that. And it's difficult to find part-time employees sometimes, especially in this labor market. Having a consultant or a consulting firm help support your needs, you have access to human resources professionals that have a deep level of human resources experience, 25 years of experience, could be less, that can help you with virtually any type of question that you have in your organization, from something that's very simple to something that's very complex. And it's easier to get someone on a more limited basis. So you're not paying a, you know, part-time or full-time salary.
So is there any advantages or disadvantages to hiring a consultant over a firm? I would think having one person that you have a relationship with would be an advantage, as opposed to hiring a firm where you might get different people at different times.
Yeah. I suppose that could be an advantage. It certainly depends on the firm. So if you're going the firm route versus a consultant, it depends on that firm. Who are they going to assign to your account? And is that person likely to be consistently working for you? Are they likely to get to know you? Are they likely to stick around for a while?
Now, I would imagine a firm would have more costs, obviously, because it's a firm. So you're going to have more administrative costs. For a small organization, maybe you can't answer this because you don't want to say something about firms, but I would think hiring an individual who's a consultant like yourself over a firm would be an advantage in terms of costs, because you don't have to pay all the administrative costs that have to go to running a firm.
Yeah. I think it just depends on it. I really think it would depend on what you need. I have another individual who helps support me, who helps support Casa Teresa. And so there's a lot of teamwork in that. What's great about that, meaning there's one more than one of me. What's great about that is if something happens to me, unfortunately, my father, as you know, was very sick and he ended up passing, which is
tragic. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
But I had a backup person. So, yeah.
So there are advantages to having a larger group because you have backups. So yeah, I'm sure there are advantages and disadvantages to both situations.
There certainly is. And Kimberly, who works, for me, I mean, the two of us are in love with Casa Teresa, you know, we would do anything to support the organization and its mission. So maybe it's a matter of finding someone that
cares about your mission.
Cares. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And you can, I know in our situation, we had an office manager who wanted to learn about HR. And so we sent her to school to learn HR and to get her certification so that we then had an HR person on staff. So that's another way small organizations can handle it. If you have someone in the office, administrative, who wants to learn HR, you can pay for them to go to school and get that certification and then be your in-house expert, which is a great thing to have.
Absolutely. We've also had clients that have had that same situation, and they've asked us to sort of be the backstop to the individual that was learning. And so we've played a mentoring role, and where they wouldn't need us full time, they just need us intermittently to help mentor and groom this person along, in addition to the schooling and certification that the individual was getting.
Now, I have a theory that I want you to either prove or disprove for me. So I have made a career running small to mid-sized organizations, and usually small organizations that turn into mid-sized organizations. And in that role, I have found that you usually can't pay a lot of salary, but I try to pay a competitive salary with other people of the same size. But you're also competing against large organizations for that pool of talent. And so what I found to be really more of an incentive than salary is benefits. So as a small organization, I have a theory that if you can only pay X number of dollars in salary, because that's what your budget allows, you can be very creative in what you add in terms of benefits. So, I mean, obviously you're going to have your usual benefits that everybody has, including, you know, health and dental and maybe a retirement. You know, we would, through Vanguard, get a 3% retirement match that we would do for full-time employees. And, you know, a lot of things that would give people incentives to become full-time and to become a manager, because a lot of people don't want to have the extra responsibility of getting to the managerial level. So you have to make it attractive by having, okay, you're going to get an exempt employee salary and you're going to get these benefits. But we could add other benefits because we were a cultural center that people use for wedding site. So we could allow people to have an event there once a year on a time when it's not generally rented. And that was a big incentive for people that they could, you know, have their family's wedding there on a Monday or a Thursday or Wednesday or something when it's not normally a rental.
That's cool.
And, you know, other little benefits like, you know, we would have birthday lunches and we would have team building events and we would take people to the Creative Edge lecture and we would give them a $400 stipend for any kind of a conference or educational opportunity that would help their position. And so that helps them and it helps us. So I am always encouraging people to think creatively about what benefits you can give people that helps them and also helps you, especially like some kind of an educational stipend or a conference stipend. What do you think about my theory now?
I like your theory. I mean, and actually, when you think about it, I haven't seen a statistic newer than 2012. But back in 2012, I think the Bureau of Labor, they did a survey. And if you total the population that serves the 401c3 sector versus the private sector and government.
We're doing a podcast with the guy who did that study.
Oh, you are?
Well, actually, it's aired before this one aired. So,
interesting.
The guy at the Bureau of Labor Statistics did the study you're talking about. And go ahead, I'll let you finish. I don't want to steal your thunder.
Well, I don't even know if we're talking about the same thing. I was just going to say that this sector makes up 10% of the
11%.
11% of the employment population. That's really a huge statistic.
Yes.
So I do agree with you.
Well, the study that he did showed that the for-profit sector and the nonprofit sector were completely in parity in terms of pay. There was no pay inequity, which is a big myth that we don't make as much. And it's all bullshit. We make exactly the same amount as the for-profit sector for organizations of the same size. What people tend to do is they look at working at Boeing, you know, as the same pay as working at Casa Teresa. No, it's not going to be applicable for a small organization to compete with Boeing salaries, right?
Correct.
But if you look at a for-profit and a nonprofit organization of the exact same size, the pay is not different.
Right. Yeah. And then all the things you talked about a few minutes ago, the additional perks and really how you're taking care of your employees. Employees love that extra recognition and they love the perks that you're talking about, whether it's tuition reimbursement or help towards their retirement savings. Those things go such a long way. It's like you're constantly stoking the fire. And maybe even more important than that is just simply how you treat your employees. So employees tend to stay at places where they've, you know, really have a great relationship with their supervisor.
Well, we couldn't get rid of our employees. Like they would never leave. but you know, one thing we did was we would find out three-tiered system for healthcare, let's say, right? And the cheapest was usually back then Kaiser. I don't think it is anymore, but back then it was always Kaiser. And there would be like Kaiser's bronze, Kaiser's silver, Kaiser gold, and then you could go to like a PPO that's not Kaiser that would be very expensive, right? And we would offer these plans and we would pay 100% of the lowest plan, and then they only paid the difference for any plan above that. And what that did for us, that added a little bit to our burden. But doing that as opposed to doing a pay raise, what a lot of people don't realize is you give somebody $1,000 a year pay raise. Sounds like a lot, right? But when you get taxes out of that and it comes out in 26 payments of biweekly salary, it's like $20 or something. It doesn't register as a lot of money to them. But if you give a $500 bonus once at Christmas time, it seems like more money, right, than $20 in your paycheck. But if you give somebody $500 or $300 a month worth of health insurance benefits that's completely paid for, they're never going to leave you because that's a really important thing. And we found that we could pay a competitive salary and really pay 100% of their benefits at the lowest level and really make them feel valued, you know, and give bonuses when they came up for people who earned them. As a one-time payout, we found better than doing it as a salary raise necessarily, you know, on a regular basis.
Right. That's a great strategy. One of the things, and maybe this is a question for you about myths and realities, but my impression is typically in this sector, more often than not, there are richer benefits.
So yes, absolutely. And I tell people, you know, I work a lot with university kids. And kids, university young adults. Mm-hmm. And none of them want to go into this as a line of work. They all want to be social entrepreneurs. They want to make a lot of money and do something good on the side, right? But when I tell them that they make the same amount of money, they're shocked. They're like, how can that be? I thought you all were poor, you know?
Right.
And then when I talk about how we have better benefits and you get to sleep at night knowing you're making the world a better place, you know, it's really a great, I think it's the best career choice a person can make. And I, to drive the point home a little more, I had a leadership teacher once who showed us a national survey. Now this was, you know, a few years back, maybe more than a decade ago, but, I don't think it's changed. They showed a national survey that had people rate what was most important to them at work, and salary was number 7.
I believe that.
Number mm-hmm. 1 was respect, always. Mm-hmm. No matter who was doing the polling, respect would always be in first place. You know, and they could check all these boxes. Salary always came in around 6 or 7. It wasn't ever, most people I think feel that if you're making enough money to be comfortable, anything over that is just gravy. It's good, right?
Absolutely.
But there's other things that are more important, like having good health care, having good dental care, having a place that respects you, being able to celebrate with your friends when somebody's made a win at work, you know, those kinds of things. So I think those little team building things like birthday lunches and me as a CEO taking somebody out one-on-one for lunch and just telling them I appreciate their work, that was an amazing thing for an employee to get, you know?
Right.
And I think there were some employees didn't even realize I noticed they were there, and I was taking them out to lunch and saying, we'd like to kind of, you know, see if you're interested in moving up the chain here and becoming a more valued employee at a higher level and, feel them out. And some people said, no, I really don't want to go into this line of work full time, but I'm having a great time now, you know?
Right.
But sometimes they did. And we got really great people from interns moving up into management, you know, by really working with them. And that to me is a good way to move people, because you're already training them. Why bring in somebody new that you have to train from scratch when you have someone that you've already believes in your mission and you've already trained them?
Absolutely. And just kind of adding on to that and on a tangent on your last comment, one of the things that we've been doing at Casa Teresa is we've been adding training programs. That's another reason that keeps employees, that increases tenure at the organization. So we've been adding training programs like dealing with conflict at work.
Which is great for the organization, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it serves two purposes, because it betters the organization as a whole, but each of the employees also feels like they're getting something out of it.
Well, plus if you're becoming a more quality organization because your people are getting better trained, not only does that help you and help them, but it helps them feel like they're part of someone who wants to be quality, right? Which makes them feel better about their work in general, too.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I think the hardest thing for a CEO of any size organization is keeping up with payroll, right? You have a new minimum wage law that comes in, and, you know, soon it'll be $15 an hour nationally, probably. And once that happens, you have to pay $30 an hour for your exempt employees. And so you have to figure out, okay, how can I bump everyone up and also bump up the people who have seniority in accordance with the new people who are going to get a raise just because of the new minimum wage? And how can I do all that and still stay within our budget? And, you know, sometimes you can go up 20% when they have these minimum wage laws come in on your budget. It's very hard for a CEO to figure that out, whether you're any kind of organization, right?
Absolutely.
So do you have any, do you have any wisdom in terms of how you can deal with that?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I certainly wouldn't be layering on any new positions. I wouldn't be adding any exempt positions because of the challenge of where this is going, unless they truly are exempt positions. And in that case, you're probably likely going to have to pay a much greater salary anyway to attract the right person to the job.
Do you think it's a better idea to let your employees know that this is a hardship for the organization and we need to figure out a solution that works with their buy-in, or do you think it's better to kind of keep it from them and be the protective dad kind of thing, you know?
I think it's circumstantial. I think that it depends on the exact situation that you're dealing with.
I should say, or protective mom.
Yeah.
In my case, it would have been. Yeah. But
yeah.
And we actually had a podcast about getting away from using your staff as family.
Oh. So,
but anyway, is it better to let them in on it and get them involved, or stay away from or keep it away from them as much as possible?
I really think it depends, because I think the first and foremost, you're going to want to do, you know, an analysis at the management or executive level to see which direction you might want to go. And then depending on which direction you go is going to drive whether or not you involve them in how you're going to roll out the changes.
That makes sense. Also, do you think, are you one of these people that thinks that it's a good idea to have transparency in terms of what people are getting paid with each other? You know, there's this new idea at offices that you let everybody know what everybody's getting paid and don't hide it. Are you in that camp, or are you in the that's not a good idea camp?
I've never been in that camp.
Okay.
well, and I think because I'm always on the end where employees talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And legally, you know, employers of any size have to abide by the National Labor Relations Act, whether or not they are unionized, right? And so employees are allowed to talk to each other about salary and such, but it never leads to a good conversation. So it's probably because of all my experience, maybe bad experience, dealing with employee relation issues where they're talking and maybe they're not paid the same salary. I haven't been in that camp.
I know for me, I've always just tried to be really fair about when people get raises and why they get raises, so that if somebody comes to my office and says, how come so-and-so is making more than me? I have an answer for them. I can say, well, because they've been here 5 years longer than you, or because they had this extra training, or they got their master's degree, or, you know, whatever the reason is that we're paying them at a different amount.
Right, right. You know, another factor just to take into consideration too is in 2009, Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter Act. So basically meaning women and men should have equal pay for the same jobs. So I think because of the way the laws are changing now, I wouldn't say all employers are 100% compliant in that area, because it's going to take time for employers to navigate through how to get compliant in that area. But I think laws are changing, and it's forcing employers to think about equal pay and to make the fair decisions. And so I think that's probably going to drive some of this really behind the scenes.
You know, I know in my case as a CEO, which I did for more than two decades, men were always quicker to ask for raises than women. And that was kind of across the board. I think very few times did a woman come into my office saying, I think I deserve a raise. But men would do it constantly. Men are generally more confident in their ability, even when they don't have as much ability as they think they do, than women, right? And so when in my case, when a man would come in and say, I think I need a raise, I would look at everybody's raise structure, because I would never make a raise for one person without looking at everyone and say, do they deserve a raise as well? You know, how long has it been since I've done raises? Is it a merit-based raise versus a cost of living raise? And looking at all those issues, because I don't think it's fair to just give somebody a raise because they asked for it.
Right, right. Well, in my experience, I wish every executive I've worked with was as analytical as you and as considerate as you, but that doesn't always happen.
No, some people will go with the squeaky wheel, right?
Absolutely.
But then, like, my wife will tell me, if I'm assertive and asking for a raise, then I'm too assertive, right? Mm-hmm. But if a man were to ask for a raise, they would never be said to be too assertive. And that's one thing that we as male employers have to look at all the time, is do we have a double standard for men versus women in terms of when they're asking for things? Do we consider it okay for men and not okay for women?
That's interesting. You know, actually, you've given me some insight that I don't think I've ever realized before.
Yeah, my wife just got laid off recently after 15 years, because a whole group of people got laid off. It wasn't something, you know, related to specifically her. But for years, she would be up for managerial positions, and she was constantly being told she was too assertive. And
wow.
Men would never hear that. You know, that's something that you hear, right? Sometimes for women, that is a total double standard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You almost expect men to be assertive, right?
Right.
So then if a woman's assertive...
Well, it's considered a positive with men, right?
Right, right.
And I think it should be a positive with women, too.
I'd agree with you. Sometimes
you have to hire people in our industry because of grants. So you get a grant, and the grant requires a new position. But then when the grant goes away, then you're in the position of, do I move this person over? Can I afford to keep them? Do I have to fire them? Which makes it easier when it's a grant hire, quote unquote, to do a contractor. you know, or to let them know that this is a temporary position. Is there any advice you can give for people who are in that situation of having to hire someone because a grant demands it?
Well, if the grant demands it, it's possible that if the duration is a short period of time, it's possible that you can classify them as a temporary part-time or full-time employee versus a contractor. I would probably steer away from classifying them as a contractor because I'm imagining they're going to put a lot of effort into your core business and that they really don't have, you really have control over them versus them having control over their services. So likely they probably wouldn't qualify as an independent contractor under the economic realities test. So if you could hire them in a temporary role, that would help. And then at the point where you no longer need them for that particular grant, you would lay them off. Unfortunately, they would be eligible for unemployment insurance. There's things like that that you couldn't dispute, but likely they would move on and they would have expected that at some point this position would be.
So if you're writing a grant and you know that the grant's going to require a temporary position, you should count into the cost of the grant the unemployment that's going to happen at the end of the grant when you have to lay that person off.
Well, if you could come up with that calculation, those are difficult calculations to do. Very difficult because an unemployment calculation is based on a number of factors. So we don't know whether that person would technically apply for unemployment or not, whether they'd be granted unemployment most likely. But then it's based on your payroll and how much unemployment's been paid out and a number of factors. So I don't think you would necessarily want to try and factor that in. It's just so complicated.
Okay. Well, that kind of covers my question. So then the last question I have for you, is there any mythology that we didn't cover that you would like to get off your chest?
No, not really. But, you know, in a nonprofit, it's probably very important to make sure that your employees don't also volunteer for your organization. So that's something just to be mindful of. So, always pay them for their hours worked.
So we used to have a situation where we decided as a staff, we wanted to give back to our organization. And we would do it by putting together a staff controlled fundraiser that only the staff did. It was a kind of a farm dinner where we would cook and serve, and the money went to our organization, and we did, you know, it was a volunteer thing. One Sunday, you know, every few months we did this. Is that illegal?
Technically you don't want your employees volunteering for the organization because you really do need to pay them for all hours worked. So if you have an employee, let's say you have a golf tournament or a gala and you have one of your employees attend on a Saturday, not their normal work day, and help support that fundraiser, you actually really need to pay them for that time so you don't get yourself into an employment law issue.
So if you have an employee that wants to volunteer and you say, sorry, I can't allow you to volunteer, I have to pay you, is there anything that prevents them from turning around and donating that pay back to the organization?
No, there really isn't. I've never run across that before, but they might want to do that. So
if someone is saying to you, you know, I really don't want to get paid, and you're saying to them, but by law, I have to pay you because you're an employee. Is there anything wrong with suggesting, well, look, if you really don't want to get paid, there's nothing that stops you from donating that money back to the organization at a later date if you want to do that. But would that be unethical to do?
Question of ethics, I'm not sure. I think it, you know, you wouldn't want the employee to ever feel pressure to do that. And the only difficult part about that is there's probably no right or wrong in this area. It's probably not black and white. But if that employee ever had an issue with the organization later on, you wouldn't want them to try and raise this as a concern. And it, you know, it might be an area that they could raise as a concern.
Now, in our field, we have employees that go beyond above and you know, beyond all the time because they care about the mission. And the people will bring in their own supplies that they paid for themselves, and you know, nobody's asked them to do this, they just do it. There's nothing you can do to control that. And you're not asking them to go out and spend their money for the organization. There's nothing you can do about that, right?
There's nothing you can do about that. I would just probably make sure that they're totally aware that it's voluntary.
And if your employees decide without management, just on their own, that they want to do something like a car wash for the organization on a Saturday, is there anything you can do about that? Do you have to then retroactively pay them if it's something they just decided on their own they wanted to do?
If technically, if you're in following employment law, yes. But as you know, in running any company, there's always a little bit of a gray area. So it's a matter of, you know, how far do you want to take it?
Yeah. Okay. Well, good. I think we covered everything. And if not, then maybe you'll come back next season and we can talk some more stuff.
Sounds great. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for doing it. And it was great to see Casa Teresa and for you to invite me here. And thanks so much for doing this.
You're welcome. You're welcome back here anytime.
Hopefully we've solved a lot of people's issues.
I hope so too.
Thank you for listening to 501c3 BS, Deprogramming for Organizational Growth. I'm your host, Zu Velasco. 501c3 BS is sponsored by the Gianeschi Center for Nonprofit Research at California State University Fullerton and the Mahalo School of Business. Join us at the Summer School for Nonprofits for one amazing week every August. Gianeschi is spelled Gianneschi. That's Gianneschi, Gianeschi Center for Nonprofit Research at California State University Fullerton and the Mahalo School of Business. Check out my Twitter feed at 501c3BS, my webpage at zootvelasco.com, and my book, The First 100 Days, on Amazon. The music is provided to us from our good friends at the traditional Brazilian choro group, Grupo Falso Baiano, and Amy Molinelli. Find them at grupofalsobaiano.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great day free from BS.